lehamishpatim asher tasim lifnehem. And these are the ordinances that you shall place before them.
Hello, I hope I haven't kept you waiting. Come right over. Ah, you're here. Good. Take the easy chair by the window. Comfortable?
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. This week's show is from Mishpatim and Shkalim. Here's your host, Phil Chernofsky.
Thank you, Ryan, and welcome to the Torah Tidbits Audio team. Ryan, for the listeners' information, is the male United States voice on the iPhone app called Speak It. And I've asked him to say a few things at the beginning and at the end of each half of the show. So, Ryan, you can go do something else now, and hopefully at the end of the half we will hear from you again.
Okay, Phil, I'll be back later.
Recording and first broadcast. Maybe I'll have Ryan say that next time. Recording and first broadcast. Yom Chamishi. I don't know how he'll do with the word Chamishi. Thursday, he probably can say, the 27th day of Shvat, 5773, corresponding to February 7th. Let's say Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130, before I forget where we're going, and then we'll settle down to the show. Shir hama'alot mima amakim kraticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli. Tihyena oznecha kashuvot lekol tachanunai. Ima vonot tishmor yoh Adonai miya amod, ki imacha hasalicha lema'an tivare. Ki viti Adonai kiveta nafshi velidvaro hochalti. Nafshi ladonai mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai hachesed veharbe imo fedut. Vehu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achinu kol beit Yisrael, hanatunim batzara uvashivya, haomedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, hamakom yirachem aleihem, viyotziyem mitzara lirvacha, umeyafela laora, umishibud lageula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv, vinomar, amen. As Ryan told you earlier, this Shabbat is both Parshat Mishpatim, and the first of the four special parshiot, the first special Shabbat, first of the four special Shabbatot, Parshat Shekalim. So let's start a little bit with Shekalim, and then we'll get into Mishpatim, and then maybe back to Shekalim. The Mishnah, we'll start with that. The first Mishnah in Masechet Shekalim says that in the olden times, on Rosh Chodesh Adar, which, by the way, is coming up on Sunday, Monday being the first day of Adar, Sunday is the 30th day of Shvat, which is also Rosh Chodesh. So on the first day of Adar, says the Mishnah, in the olden times, they used to make announcements throughout the Jewish communities in Israel about two things, Shekalim and Kalayim. Shekalim refers to the collection of the silver half-shekel coin that was taken from every adult male above the age, or from the age of 20. Women were not obligated to give, but it was accepted from them. Interestingly, it was not accepted from a non-Jew who lives in Israel, even one who is committed to keep the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, the seven Noahide laws. This was an annual membership tax for the Jewish people. The money that was collected during Adar was used in the Beit HaMikdash starting Rosh Chodesh Nisan, for the purchase of communal offerings and other needs of the community. What's very much stressed here is that everyone has an equal share in these special sacred communal activity in the Holy Temple and the Beit HaMikdash. So, doesn't matter how wealthy a person was, he gave half shekel, he wanted to give extra, he could give extra, but the half shekel collection, which had certain uses, was equal to all people. And a poor person had to put together his pennies in order to get that silver half shekel. There's actually a lot of comment about the fact that it was a half shekel, and at times in the past, when we've had different denominations of coins in ancient Israel, there was one, I don't remember which one it was, which was equal to a half shekel, let's say a dinar. I don't think that's what it was, but let's say a dinar. But a person couldn't give a silver dinar. He had to give a half shekel, because half means part, and part means that you are part of a whole, not a whole in and of yourself. And that was a message that comes across from this mitzvah of the half shekel. So in the olden times, when we had the Beit HaMikdash and we had a Sanhedrin and everything else that was necessary in Eretz Yisrael, Rosh Chodesh Adar, the announcement was made to get your half shekel ready for the official collection later that month. Corresponding to that practice, we have two things. We have on the Shabbat of Rosh Chodesh Adar, or immediately before, which is what it is this year, we read in a second Torah scroll the portion of the mitzvah of Machatzit HaShekel, the half silver shekel, the silver half shekel, from the beginning of Parshat Ki Tisa. And that is a commemoration of the actual performance of the mitzvah when we have a Beit HaMikdash. The other minhag that comes from it is the giving to certain charities, and shuls provide collection boxes for these purposes, 3 half shekel coins, or half dollar coins, or half franc coins, whatever country a person lives in, as a commemoration of the mitzvah of Machatzit HaShekel. That money is usually given right before Megillah reading on Purim, because there is a connection between not just the month of Adar, when the Shkalim were collected, and not just Rosh Chodesh Adar, when the Shkalim were announced, but there's a Purim connection as well, because Haman, in order to get permission from the king, Ahasuerus, to destroy the Jewish people, offered money to the treasury and received permission. The shekalim, so to speak, that Haman offered Ahasuerus are countered by our shekalim, which we fulfill the mitzvah every year in the time of the Beit HaMikdash. It's almost like it's a preventative measure, an antidote, a vaccine against the wicked shekalim that Haman offered to destroy the Jewish people. And the shekalim which we give, that's our vaccination against it in fulfillment of the mitzvah. And there's another angle to it which is very important. Haman's pitch to Ahasuerus was that among his provinces there is a people who are miforad u mifuzar, scattered throughout his kingdom. They're not unified. It's not going to be a risky thing to get rid of them. Leave that to me. You'll be enriched, and we'll get rid of the Jews. Our specific concept of half a shekel plus the concept of mishloach manot, people sending gifts of food from one to another on Purim day, and matanot le'evyonim, a focus on gifts to the poor, is to put a lie to this statement of Haman. We are not a separated people. We might be scattered around communities in the world, but we have a sense of Jewish unity and care for each other that is exemplified by the mitzvot of Purim and by the mitzvah of machatzit ha-shekel, the silver half shekel. And therefore, that's a second minhag of giving zecher l'machatzit ha-shekel right before Megillah reading. Now, I mentioned earlier that the Mishnah mentions there were two announcements that were made at the beginning of Adar. One was shekalim, which is our topic for now. The other was kalayim, which is not related. Kalayim is a practical situation in the land of Israel when a farmer with a field that he has been planting a grain in for the last number of years, and he decides he's switching and making his property into a vineyard. So he plows the ground under, over, whatever you call it, and he plants grapes, and he has vines crawling up on those trellises, and there's a potential problem. And that problem is that a vineyard is not allowed to have any grain growing within it. So it's in the beginning of Adar, at the end of the rainy season, or right after the rainy season, when young green shoots of wheat, barley, whatever, start peeking up from the ground, that the farmers have to be reminded that they have to check their fields and uproot these shoots, because if you leave them to grow in the vineyard, it will not only be a violation of the Torah, but it also forbids anyone from eating or drinking the product. That means if a landowner has a vineyard and he's not careful to avoid kalai kerem, that's what it's called, then the winery, which he made a deal with, a very lucrative deal for him, for his grapes, won't accept them. They need a certificate from the deputies and officers of the Sanhedrin. We checked the field of so-and-so at such-and-such location, and we find it to be kelayim free. Therefore, that was something that was also announced at the beginning of Adar. Let me now recap something I said last week and spent time on, because it's equally appropriate for this week. And this will sort of be a review, and I won't expound upon it as much as I did last week. You ask the average person in what portion of the Bible, of the Chumash, of the Torah, do we find the account, the story of the receiving of the Torah? The average person will answer in last week's Torah reading, Parshat Yitro. That's only a partially correct answer, because we find at the end of this week's reading, the end of Parshat Mishpatim, we have the continuation of the story of the Sinai experience. Ask the same people how long a period of time was the process of receiving the Torah. They'll say, one day, which is what we celebrate with the holiday of Shavuot, which we call Zman Matan Toratenu, the time of the receiving of our Torah. Again, only a partial answer. Because after that day of revelation at Sinai, when the people heard the Ten Commandments, when the people heard God say, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, Asher Otzeiticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim Mi'beit Avadim, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, that was only the beginning of the process of Matan Torah. That was the down payment. The Ten Commandments were heard by the multitude of people, 2 to 3 million Jews, and the experience at Sinai with the mountains smoking and fire and lightning and thunder and the sound of the shofar and the trembling and the fear that the people had and the sense of panic, that was on the specific day of revelation at Sinai. But immediately thereafter, immediately, God says to Moshe, who had been down with the people at that very important experience of divine revelation to the people, God says to Moshe, now you come up the mountain to me, and I will give you the tablets of stone with the Aseret HaDibrot written on them. I will give you the Torah and the mitzvah, meaning mitzvot, meaning the whole Torah, the whole body of not just the written word, but the oral law, in the form of the mitzvot which God is commanding the people to follow. That is expressed in the end of Mishpatim. You might ask, and it would be a good question, what's it doing at the end of Mishpatim when it belongs sequentially at the end of Parshat Yitro? My answer for that is that by taking this piece of the end of the story and holding it for the end of Mishpatim, it sets two bookends, story of Matan Torah and rest of the story of Matan Torah on either side, and in between you have more than just the Aseret HaDibrot, the Ten Commandments, which, by the way, comprise 14 out of the 613 mitzvot, but the end of Yitro follows with 3 more mitzvot, and the Parsha, the Sedra of Mishpatim, follows with 53 more mitzvot. So you've got 53 and 17 is 70 mitzvot, and this is by no means all that was there, but you get that very powerful feeling that the detail of mitzvah in this week's Seder of Mishpatim was not an afterthought, was not Moshe Rabbeinu's attempt to explain the Torah. It was part of revelation at Sinai. It's true that we heard at Sinai, honor thy father and thy mother. Remember the Sabbath day to make it holy. Thou shalt not kidnap. Thou shalt not murder. Thou shalt not bear false witness. And the et cetera's. And the mitzvot in this week's Sedra of Mishpatim were commanded and taught to Moshe Rabbeinu, explained to him by God, and he was in charge of transmitting this to the people. In fact, we were the ones who created this system of transmission of the oral law and the content of the Torah from a prophet, because we panicked and we said, we don't want to hear God's voice anymore. God said, okay, I'll go along with that on the condition that you listen to what Moshe tells you, to other prophets in the future, what they tell you, as if you heard it directly from God himself. Otherwise, there's no deal. So, Mishpatim, which you'll see examples of in a moment, brings us down from that lofty experience that is not just Sinai, but previously was the sea and the splitting of the sea, and the song of the sea, and before that, the wonders in Egypt, we've had a run of very high drama, actually starting Shemot, Vaera, Bo, Beshalach, Yitro, and in Mishpatim, we're talking mundane, everyday things, but no less from Sinai than any of the others. So when you have a simple matter of, can I borrow your video camera? I'm going on a tiul, and you bring it back that evening to return to the owner, and it's broken, then you have a classic example of a lender and a borrower, and damage, and who's responsible, and who has to pay for the damage, and a claim and a counterclaim. Is negligence a factor or not? These are part of what civil law allows us to function as a society. This was not separated from Sinai, proof of which is the first part of the story is in Parshat Yitro. The end of the story of Revelation at Sinai was at the end of Mishpatim, and all of this was in between. So this is either the tuna fish of the sandwich, or the lettuce of the sandwich, or the pickle, or the onion, or the tomato, whatever you put in your tuna fish sandwich. Of course, peanut butter is an option as well. And that's why I believe the Torah is presented to us in that fashion. So the topic that I alluded to before is called Arba'a Shomrim, the four watchmen or guardians. There's a Shomer Chinam, can you do me a favor and keep an eye on my apartment when I go away for 3 days, take in the mail, water the plants, and just keep an eye on it. That's a Shomer Chinam type of setting. Can I hire you to watch my sheep or my car while I'm away? I said sheep, then people will think, well, I don't have any sheep, so this doesn't apply to me. You have a car, it applies to a car. You have an iPad, it applies to an iPad.
Speaking of iPads, we'll be right back with more Torah Tidbits Audio shortly. You are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio. Here with more is Phil.
Thank you again, Ryan. Okay. I'll jump a little now. Ve'ela ha-mishpatim. Mishpatim, singular, mishpat, is generally considered to be the kind of command, the kind of mitzvah, that is logical, reasonable, common sense, and societies all over the world throughout history come up with these ideas on their own by virtue of their humanity, I guess. Divinely inspired, to be sure, but I'm now using the term mishpat to apply to many of the mitzvot in this parsha and elsewhere in the Torah. For example, to properly judge damages. Obvious case, there are many mitzvot related to different kinds of damage, but if you're barbecuing and an ember piece of newspaper you used for the fire with fire on it flies off in the wind and lands on your neighbor's recliner, and it ignites the stuffing, which was sticking out of a little hole, and his chair burns up completely. You have a certain responsibility. This is part of Torah law, but it belongs to that category of Torah law, which is reasonable, common sense, as I said, logical, and peoples would come up with a concept of functioning in their society with responsibility for what happens as a result of your negligence. That's a mishpat. Take a different example of a different mitzvah in Parshat Mishpatim, and you might want to claim it's a little out of place, because what I'm going to say now is not a mishpat. It's the other kind of mitzvah, the one known as chok, the one that is not logical, not common sense, not reasonable, not something that people would come up with on their own, and that is the prohibition of cooking meat in milk. Meat in milk. You could cook meat in water. You could cook it in tomato juice. Why can't you cook it in milk? Milk comes from a cow, so does meat come from a cow or whatever animal? And without the Torah prohibiting the eating of milk and meat, I don't think we would come up with that on our own. I don't think any society would come up with that on their own. That's more in the definition, let's say a generalization that I am using for the opposite of a mishpat, a chok. What I want to now try to get across is not a main theme in Mishpatim, but it's to me an important theme in all of the mitzvot and all of Torah. We could look at it from two ways. I chose in the lead tidbit this week in the hard copy of Torah Tidbits to look at it from one direction, but I want to now explore it from two directions. And that is the element of chok within any mishpat, and the element of mishpat, or at least reason, or at least message and lesson, in any chok. As far as the mishpatim are concerned, whatever I used as an example before seemed reasonable. Here's another. To lend money to the poor. Okay. But watch this one. Not to be demanding of a poor man unable to pay his debt. A guy comes to his friend and says, I am really in hard times now. Can I borrow $1,000 shekel? $1,000, whatever. And his friend gladly lends him the money, and they agree that in 6 months' time he will pay the debt back. And that's the reasonable expectation at the time because of monies that he's expecting. And it comes towards the end of the 6 months, and maybe goes a little over the 6 months, and the lender should be entitled to say to the borrower, you owe me $1,000 shekel, where's my money? If you know that the person can't pay you back now, a mitzvah in the Torah says don't be demanding of that, because all you'll do is make him feel worse. He can't pay you back, so he'll break down and cry. So he'll be ashamed. But what are you going to accomplish? Now, all of this, what I just said, is my own thinking about it. The Torah just says, don't do it. So here's an example where logic and common sense and the way the world usually functions is not so clear that it comes from that. Here, we're dealing with a command from God without which I don't think we would go this far. We would say, I lent him money. I didn't take any interest. That's another thing we should discuss, which is also from this week's Torah portion. And elsewhere, we find you're allowed to take a security for the loan. So you're now having his silver tea service which he got as a wedding gift and hardly uses. And then he's making a get-together with his boss or his in-laws or whatever, and he wants the tea service in order to serve tea and have it a little bit mechubad, a little dignified. You have to give it back to him. Maybe you weren't even allowed to take it in the first place because it's related to food, to the presentation of food. So all of these elements start with a reasonable, logical, common sense kind of idea, but the details sort of go beyond the logic and the reasonableness, and that's fine, because we are dealing with not only with God who commands us these things, but with God who wants us to rise in Kedusha, in sanctity, above the commonplace, average, reasonable kind of behavior. In fact, from our perspective, the rest of the world is just supposed to be reasonably good people. The extra challenge of spirituality is something which we consider to be special from the Torah to the Jewish people. So within the Mishpatim, you have elements of do it because this is the way God commanded it. And that's fine, because the Torah is made up of Mishpatim and Chukim. But what I'm suggesting is that the Mishpatim themselves have elements of Chok. I'll see if I could come up with another example or something maybe a little bit better. Here it is. To rest on the Shabbat day means to abstain from doing melacha. Well, to be sure, there are elements in the concept of a day of rest once a week that are very reasonable and common sense. Many religions have the concept of a Sabbath day. But then you get a challenge like I've gotten. I remember very well when I was in the army, I was one of two kippah-wearing Jews in a unit of 50 guys, some of which kept their distance and others of which argued with me all the time. So one guy challenged me once. He says, "You mean to tell me that it's better to walk for 15 minutes on a Shabbat morning in the middle of the summer, schwitzing away, and arriving at shul, at the synagogue, drained and exhausted from the walk, and hot and wet and bothered by the sun? How am I supposed to pray? When I could drive for 5 minutes in my air-conditioned car, and then I'll be able to be a mensch and have a nice prayer." Okay, that is a challenge to the logic and the common sense of Shabbat. And we have our answers for that. Our answers are, it is not work, labor, sweat that the Torah is prohibiting on Shabbat. It is creative melacha, creative activities, which God is commanding us to abstain from on Shabbat, because we need to recharge our batteries, not just resting so that the labors of the week, which exhausted us, we will now refresh ourselves. It's more than that. It's the creative activities which we expend and do all throughout our work week are not to be taken for granted, are to be seen as gifts from God. And when he says, yes, do the 6 days a week, but not on the seventh, then the going into the car and turning it on and stepping on the accelerator and forcing vaporized gasoline into an internal chamber, which then is sparked and causes an explosion and a piston to go up and down. I don't know if it's still done the same way, but that's what I learned. This is a very creative activity, more creative than just walking. And that's the kind of thing which we tend to take for granted, and it's on the list of those things which are not to be done on Shabbat. So I could say to this fellow, yes, you have a logical question, and my answer is not necessarily logical, unless you want to say that what I'm saying is we have the wrong notion of 6 days you shall work, labor, slash, whatever, and on the seventh day you shall rest from labor. People think in terms of manual labor and sweat-inducing activity, and that's not an accurate description of exactly what we're not allowed to do. Striking a match. This is another person said to me. In the olden times, you had to rub sticks together and a lot of friction and it was hard work and hopefully the tinder would catch or strike a stone against a flint against a stone and yabba dabba doo and that will cause a fire. Okay, a lot of work. I could see that. Striking a match or flicking a lighter? What's the work in that? Not the point. What's the malacha in that? What's the creative activity in that? Same stuff. The creative activity of producing fire is one of those activities which God said not on Shabbat. So sometimes you have to just explain what seems to be illogical and not reasonable and not common sense, and then it works out. Now the other side of the coin, and I don't know if it's really the other side of the same coin, and I don't know if I'm going to do justice to this either. But I've spoken about this often enough. Let's revisit the prohibition of milk and meat. On the face of it, we can say this is a chok of the Torah. It is a command of God that we do not mix milk and meat. We don't cook meat and milk. We don't eat those mixtures. We don't even derive any benefit from those mixtures. And that's what God commands. But this is not our nature. Our nature is to try to understand, to get a handle on understanding why we're commanded to do certain things or prohibited to do other things. Because human beings need that. So what we have to mention is something also from this week's Torah reading and also from the end portion, which is the continuation of the story of receiving of the Torah and a very important part of the story. The two-word phrase that the people of Israel that encapsulate, that epitomizes who we are as a people is when we, the people of Israel, at Sinai, 2 to 3 million souls and all future generations in their wake, announced, the people said to Moshe, Kol Asher Diber Hashem, everything that God speaks, Na'aseh, we will do, v'nishma, and we will understand. The putting first, na'aseh, and then nishma, is not common sense and logical. I often joke with people when I say, can you do me a favor? Or someone else says, can you do me a favor? Some people answer, yes. And that's nice. But they didn't hear the favor yet. And they might not want to do it when they hear what it is. Most people will say, can you do me a favor? What? Or, it depends on what. Usually they'll be more polite and say, what? So you tell them the favor, and then they make a decision whether they do it or not. And that works many times in interpersonal relationships, but there's a certain point in some relationships, be it a parent and a child, or husband and wife, or brother and sister, or good friends, where one has to come to the other and say, I'm going to ask you to do something. Please don't ask me why. I need it done. And I need it done now. That level of relationship was expressed by the children of Israel to God via Moshe with the words, Na'aseh v'nishma. We will do it. V'nishma means we will try, I'm adding that word, to understand to the best of our ability why we're doing it. Because that helps us do it better, do it with more enthusiasm. On that note, I should tell you that the author of the most popular book of the 613 mitzvot, the author of the Sefer HaChinuch, a Rabbi Aharon of Barcelona from the 1200s or so, writes in his introduction where his work analyzes almost all of the 613 mitzvot and gives reasons, not just the reasonable, logical, common sense ones for certain mitzvot, the mishpatim, but even for the chukim, almost all, not quite. But he writes in his introduction that I and my peers don't need reasons to commit ourselves to do God's bidding. That's in our nature. We do it because we're told. But what could I do? I have a son. He's part of a new generation. He and his friends are always asking why. And I'm writing this book for him. What appeals to me about that is the fact that it was 800 years ago, and it hasn't changed. Not only hasn't it changed, but I, and I'm sure many of the listeners, were once upon a time, not that long ago, part of the, quote, younger generation who are always asking questions why. And I, and many people listening and other people, have grown and matured to the point where they are more ready to accept and do what God commands, even if they haven't achieved the reasons yet. And they say sometimes, but what could I do? My children, and now my grandchildren, are asking questions and they have to have answers. So we're not supposed to be like the motto of the state of Missouri, show me. I had a guy once said, if you could convince me that I should keep Shabbat, I'll give it a try. Unfortunately, that's not the way it's supposed to work. Further, unfortunately, I had to do it anyway. Because when a Jew says that to you, that's a challenge, and you have to help him. But it shouldn't be like that. It should be everything that God says I will do, and then I will spend as much of my energies and time as I can to try to understand why, to get a handle on it. So now let's go back to milk and meat and be specific. First of all, some of our sources say that there is an idolatry element to the cooking of milk and meat. Remember that the image in the Torah's words is not meat in milk, it's gedi, the young of an animal, in the milk of its mother. Now that's not the whole extent of the prohibition. The prohibition includes older animals' meat with milk of any animal that's kosher, are forbidden mixtures, but the language in the Torah was making a point. To take the young animal, slaughter it, cook its meat in the milk of its mother is an arrogant, almost mockery of nature. That milk is what was supposed to nourish that young animal into its adulthood. It's milk is a life-giving thing. And here, if a person does that, it's either a mockery of nature, or in the case of certain idolatrous practices, it was purposely done as a sign of our dominance, our complete domination of the natural world. Our perspective is God allows us many things. We want to eat meat, we can take a kosher animal, slaughter it, and prepare its meat and eat it. That we have permission for. But there are limits that are placed in order to make sure we understand what's going on and we keep things in a certain perspective. Don't have too much time for all of this. Aver min hachai, limb from a living animal, forbidden. In the case of Jewish law, in addition, you have proper religious slaughter, which many people say is a very humane way of killing the animal. So it's not ignoring the plight of the animal, but it's beneficial in our use of that permission. But milk and meat especially has that image in our mind of that is one of our limits. And having a limit from God helps us appreciate the permission to take milk from the cow and drink it, and permission to slaughter a cow and have its meat. We're out of time, so I have enough time without even Ryan to wish you a Shabbat Shalom, a Chodesh Tov, Lehishtameah.